KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. North Korea said it successfully tested a hydrogen bomb on Sunday following a blast that caused a 6.3 magnitude earthquake and yielded more destructive power than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. President Trump issued a series of tweets in the days following, accusing the South Koreans of appeasement and suggesting the United States stop trade with countries doing business in North Korea. Meanwhile, Russia's President Vladimir Putin said on Tuesday, yesterday that is, that the intensifying rhetoric between the U.S. and Pyongyang could lead to global catastrophe. Admiral James Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander for NATO and now Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, joins us this segment to talk about the escalating North Korean crisis and about his new book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Welcome, Commander. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Michael.
I guess I'd like to begin, actually, by letting listeners know that your book, which is quite ambitious, actually talks a good deal about the oceans as the center of international trade. And now we have the president really tying international trade and trade policy to foreign policy. As I mentioned in the introduction, I'd like to get your comment on this, your thoughts about this. It's a big connection, particularly with respect to North Korea.
It is indeed. And, you know, what we need to remember, Michael, is that in the end, all roads to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, lead through Beijing. We're not going to solve this by simply using the military option that is not efficient or useful, I believe. We're not going to solve it by intensely applying U.S. sanctions. At the end of the day, China has enormous control over the economy of North Korea. Therefore, we do need to work with China to solve it, and therefore, we need to balance economic and diplomatic incentives and disincentives with our Chinese colleagues if we're going to solve this.
Our Chinese colleagues seem to have this on a kind of low priority, at least in terms of hierarchy. I'm sorry to put it so bluntly, but the fact is they recognize that there's a real refugee problem ahead, and the Korean Peninsula may turn in a different direction if indeed they cast their fate along with the United States. And why should they probably cast their fate with the United States?
I think they should for two reasons. The first is which you have mentioned, which is if this thing really goes sideways, and the chances of that are increasing rapidly, if it really goes sideways, it's going to crack, if not the global economy, certainly the Asian economy, to extreme economic detriment for China. And secondly, as you point out, refugees and a potential political shift creating a unified peninsula. Those are two pretty powerful reasons that I think China needs to reel in Kim Jong-un, and I believe they have the capacity to do so. And I think it is rising on their priority list as they see the increasing consequences of a potential U.S. military response.
But again, we get back, Commander, to trade. You know, the United States is, I mean, in fact, during the campaign, President Trump was talking about a trade war against China, and indeed, it seems as if there is a good deal of hostility where China is concerned. But he would need to work even more closely with South Korea. And now he's charging South Korea with appeasement and saying that they're holding things up and it's their fault.
Which I think is an enormous mistake, as I believe also it's a mistake to use this particular moment to try and abrogate the free trade agreement with South Korea. There might be a time to renegotiate that, but this is not it. At the moment, we're to be standing very closely with our South Korean allies. And, Michael, I would submit that we spend too much time publicly talking about North Korea and not enough time talking quietly and effectively with our South Korean allies, who, after all, really understand the North in ways that we're never going to completely understand. So I believe the appeasement tweet was a mistake. I think trying to walk away from the free trade agreement would be a mistake, and I hope that part of the package of things we do, along with working with China, will be working more closely and in better alignment with our South Korean allies.
Well, this free trade agreement is 5 years old, but our military alliance with North Korea is 67 years old, and as you have pointed out in this 10-point plan that you've put forward, counseling with North Korea is really a central part of the necessity of what we need to do. But you also say that if it comes to blows, and you've advised against this, a long-range strike against their nuclear program or a cyber offensive would be really the only options. And I'm wondering, do you think there's anything like Stuxnet here, like some kind of computer worm that the United States has, that they did with Iran?
I think without broaching into classified information, I'll simply say that the United States has a strong array of offensive cyber capability. Stuxnet was something that kind of got released into the wild in ways that were very detrimental, according to press reports. I think the U.S. has much more targeted means of using cyber offensively. I'm sure the president is reviewing that package of options as well.
And do we need to make it difficult for China? In other words, do we squeeze China so they can squeeze North Korea?
I think we're approaching that point, Michael. We're not quite there that we would want to levy broad economic sanctions on China, but I think we're very close to using targeted, if you will, precision-guided sanctions against Chinese firms that are doing significant levels of business in North Korea. We've done this once or twice in the past, and China has been reluctant to expand that into a broader trade confrontation. So I think, again, that Chinese priorities here are rising because they see the real downside if this thing comes to blows. And I think from the U.S. perspective, we truly want to avoid the military option because the humanitarian costs on the peninsula are enormous.
We're talking with former NATO Commander James Stravitis about the North Korean crisis. He's the author of Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, which is kind of staggeringly ambitious title, subtitle as well, if I may say so, Commander. But you do take, you really, in fact, you get into the whole South China Sea mess in your book, don't you?
I do, and the book is structured around a look at each of the world's oceans, Michael, and I spent 37 years in the Navy sailing those seas. And so what I tried to do was, for each of the oceans, provide a bit of a snapshot of how we got to where we are today. And the segment on the South China Sea and on the Western Pacific, I think, are of immediate interest because of what's happening today on the Korean Peninsula, which is, in fact, a peninsula surrounded by water. Whatever we do will involve a great deal of our capability from the sea.
Have things changed because of this hydrogen bomb test? Does that move the needle at all, or is that a game changer in your judgment?
It is, and it's for two reasons. One is the obvious high increase in military lethality. That's obvious. But I think secondly, Michael, is the extreme recklessness of the decision that Kim Jong-un has made. Part of what we need to do here is figure out him and his psychology. And this is not a promising sign that despite all of the international approbation that he faced, he chose not only to detonate another nuclear weapon, but to detonate a massive hydrogen bomb. That's deeply concerning in terms of understanding his psychology.
Well, we don't know what he wants. Understanding his psychology remains a major enigma. Nikki Haley recently in the United Nations said what he really wants is war, and I don't know that she's wrong about that. But yeah.
I think she's wrong that he wants war. I think what he wants is to own weapons of mass destruction, to achieve respect from the international community as evidenced by engagement and dialogue, and to continue living his very pleasant lifestyle. He's married to a beautiful Korean woman. He has a family. He's got complete power in this dystopian world he's created. He likes it. So I think that's what he wants, is weapons of mass destruction to ensure his position and a modicum of respect. I think we can navigate through that, perhaps by freezing his nuclear weapons program at a level that we can live with, which is below hydrogen and below intercontinental missile.
Well, he's not going to give them up. All he has to do is look at,
nope.
He probably has, look at what happened with Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi, who
exactly.
Both... Yeah. Let me give out the phone number if you'd like to join us. Again, we're talking with the former NATO commander, James Stravitis, about the North Korean crisis. We're also talking about his book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. And you are certainly welcome to join this conversation. I invite you to do that. We're at what has been described as a very important moment now with the ICBMs and the hydrogen test and nuclear warheads. These things have crossed, and obviously we're at a juncture that is terrifying. I mean, that's probably the only appropriate word to describe it. If you'd like to weigh in here, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by joining us Telephone 866-733-6786 is the number to call, and we do welcome your calls. So again, feel free to be part of the program. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and also tweet us if you would prefer. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. I should say that this has been compared to the Cuban Missile Crisis, but has been going on a lot longer. And Robert Litwack of the Wilson Center, who we had on earlier this year, said that this is an inflection point. Either bomb or you acquiesce or you negotiate. And the only sensible thing here, I suppose, would be diplomacy. But let me just go back to you, Commander, for a moment, because you've put a good deal of trust in our generals. In General Kelly and Mattis and McMaster, and feel that they represent a real check on our president, who many feel shoots from the Twitter hip too often and too easily?
I do. I think that the president has demonstrated that he's highly impulsive. We know that he's not experienced in any way in the international world, and particularly in the world of security studies, and particularly in escalatory potential military action. So he needs individuals around him who have some experience in those things. I know all three of the generals you mentioned extremely well, particularly Kelly, now the chief of staff. I've known him for 40 years. These are very steady, intelligent, non-impulsive men who do not come to the table with a big ego. They want to get this to come out right, right meaning we don't end up in a military exchange, which again would be catastrophic on the peninsula. So I think we have the right team around him at the moment. I'll tell you who is.
But excuse me, you got Defense Secretary Mattis saying one thing and the president saying another thing. I mean, they're really cross purposes.
Of course, we see that with some frequency in this administration. And what I tell our overseas friends with whom I have this conversation, watch what the administration does, not what the tweet says. And it's an unfortunate way to conduct business. I was going to say, Michael, who is missing in this conversation is our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. We haven't heard much from him about this. He's a very experienced global businessman. I'd like to see him more engaged in the conversation than we've seen him thus far.
Well, let's have our listeners engage in this conversation. And, Philip, we'll begin with you as our first caller. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. The reason the North Koreans claim that they have nuclear weapons and are developing nuclear weapons is a fear that they'll be invaded because of their past history. This is the same issue that the Iranians bring up. Why doesn't the U.S. potentially offer a non-aggression pact that if Korea, North Korea doesn't, put its power force beyond its border, that, you know, that we have a non-aggression pact that we won't do anything. They can do whatever they want within North Korea. As a precondition for them to denuclearize.
What about a non-aggression pact, Commander?
It's an interesting and a potentially useful construct. In many ways, you're starting to see that part of the conversation unfold as you hear the generals talking about, look, we don't want to overthrow the regime. We don't want to invade North Korea. And I can assure you, having spent 37 years in the military, worked in the Pentagon, I've looked at every war plan this nation has. We don't have plans sitting around to invade North Korea. And frankly, there's not much there we would want. So the idea of non-aggression, how you structure it diplomatically, I can think of a couple ways to do it, but I think it's a reasonable idea. And I think the germ of the idea that's right is we need to get into talks, probably four-party, U.S., China, North Korea, South Korea, maybe six-party, adding Russia and Japan. That's the next step. Non-aggression could be part of that conversation.
Of course, we did have an agreement, and the North Koreans violated it. I'm talking about the former nuclear freeze we had on under Kim Jong-un's
Indeed.
Father, Kim Jong-il. Yeah.
Indeed. I think the point of four-party, six-party talks is China would become the guarantor of North Korean behavior. They've never formally taken that on, and I think that would have to be tied to any conversation about non-aggression pact.
Here's John joining us. John, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. Hi, Michael. Let me just get off the speaker. Hi there. Sorry. Thank you. I wanted to ask about the vulnerability of Guam, and it seems like even if Kim Jong-un doesn't actually shoot anything over, he's that's the closest territory, U.S. territory, to North Korea, and it could be sort of a hostage situation where he shows that he can do it, and now we're always vulnerable to that.
Yeah. Commander?
A wonderful point, and absolutely correct. The most at-risk portion of U.S. territory of any kind is, in fact, Guam. So what should we be doing about it? Number one, we ought to be increasing the missile defense capability there. That's both mid-cruise, which is putting ships between Guam and North Korea, and on the island itself, adding to the terminal phase air defense package. Number two, we ought to continue, as we've been talking about this morning, to pressurize North Korea in a deterrent regime that says to them, and General Mattis did this, I think, appropriately, calmly, coolly, on the White House front lawn 3 days ago, that any attack that destroys U.S. property or kills U.S. citizens will be met with a significant military response. And third, again, we ought to be working with our allies in the region. Both Japan and South Korea have very good maritime capability. We have mutual defense treaties with both of them. They can be part of the Guam defense piece of this. So we've got some cards to play, but John, you're right. Guam is a vulnerable point in this.
And John, I thank you for the call. I'm getting a lot of tweets from people who are slapping my hands for calling you Commander, because these are a lot of these old Navy guys say you should be called Admiral. I mean, you're both. You prefer Admiral?
Admiral is probably slightly more correct. Either one is fine, Michael, but okay. Admiral is normal.
Okay. Let me read a comment from Mason who says, first from Vincent, who says, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea know that they can quickly and cheaply sink each aircraft carrier and its six surrounding ships. And this is to your role as admiral. Why is our taxpayer-funded Navy mostly configured to fight the aircraft carrier battles of the World War II all over again? Why doesn't the Navy mothball its aircraft carriers and use all the money saved for the small ships it actually needs?
Take a look at how we've used carriers, really, since their invention, but particularly, in, to your caller's point, in the post-World War II era. Every time we want to project power, every time we want to use large amounts of American air power, those carriers, which are 8 acres, they can travel 1,000 miles a day. They have very, very capable self-defense systems. They are surrounded, as the caller points out, by support ships that defend them. They are a very hard target, and I would argue that their day is not gone yet. However, it is appropriate that we think about distributed lethality in the fleet, bringing more smaller ships that take advantage of unmanned vehicles, of cyber, of autonomous strike. So it's a mix of both, but it's not an on and off switch of let's get rid of the carriers and just do the other things. We still need to dial that rheostat in. The carriers will continue to be important elements of American power for the next decade at least.
Here's Mason who says, does North Korea have a legal right to conduct missile testing in international waters? Why does America feel entitled to conduct military exercises in the Persian Gulf and South China Sea, but we protest when a country like North Korea does something similarly provocative?
The difference is that North Korea is under United Nations sanctions against conducting attacks like this, missile tests like this. Number two is that Korea talks constantly about turning other nations into a sea of fire. So when you construct both a violation of UN Security Council resolutions and you add to it the stated intent of the regime to conduct offensive operations, it becomes untenable under international law, a violation of international law.
But our military operations, we keep hearing from North Korea, are a threat to them, a menace to them. That's what's making them in this kind of warlike state. At least that's the propaganda they put out. Should we be doing all these? We just did some more with South Korea, for example, and Japan.
We should be responding to the level of threat that we see from North Korea, which is to say this is the most militarized society in the world. They have the largest standing army in Asia, saving only that of China. They constantly conduct offensive military operations. In the last several years, they've sunk South Korean ships. They've launched artillery barrages at South Korean territory. They are the offenders in every sense in this relationship. South Korea, in fact, has tried policies. This is what led to President Trump's tweet about appeasement. You know, one man's appeasement is another man's reasonable engagement. South Korea has tried to engage. And so I think without question, North Korea is the offensive power in this, and we have to be ready to respond. And I think Kim Jong-un's actions, including detonating a hydrogen bomb, pretty much speak for themselves in terms of who's the potential offender here.
Well, here's a strong opinion from one of our listeners, Radu, who says, all this talk is empty. I've been hearing about how unacceptable it is for North Korea to have nukes for decades. We've done nothing effective to slow them down, either take them out or just stop talking about it.
Well, that's a nice, clean way of looking at it. I do agree with one element in that statement, which is we're now at a point where we do have to do something. We have to make a conscious decision whether to take them out, launch a military option, which I think is a bad one because of the enormous number of casualties, whether we attempt one more time but with massive economic sanctions to bring a diplomatic conclusion, or we decide we're going to live with this and continue under a deterrent regime. The reason this is a different moment, Michael, and to the writer, is the confluence of the hydrogen bomb plus the extended range of the intercontinental ballistic missiles. This is a different moment than we've seen before.
And what do you think about the idea that Ryan wants to know there's so much suffering in North Korea that perhaps there's a chance of a sudden, unexpected collapse of the state, as we saw in Romania back in 1989?
It seems unlikely to me, based on all the intelligence that I've read over decades and also observing Kim Jong-un over the period of time in which he's been in power, less than a decade, but he's absolutely consolidated power there. I'd recommend a book to your readers. It's called The Orphan Master's Son by Johnson, and it is an extraordinary view.
It's Adam Johnson. He's a Stanford professor and has been on the show a number of times, and it won
He's
a Pulitzer
fantastic.
Prize.
And the book is fantastic. It won either a Pulitzer or a National Book Award.
Well,
absolutely.
Won both of
highly
them, perhaps,
recommend.
I think.
Yeah, and so highly recommend that as dead-on accurate portrayal of this regime and why it's very unlikely that grip on power will be released.
Second, your recommendation, and you're listening to Forum, and we are talking to former NATO commander James Servetus, Admiral Servetus, with us on phone here, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to more of your callers. Let's go next to Pleasanton. Mark, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for another terrific program, as usual, Michael, and for taking my call. I have a question for the Admiral. I think most of us would probably agree with the premise that if North Korea has nuclear weapons, it would be able to hold the region and perhaps us as well quite hostage to almost anything that it really would want to do. I think the threshold of a nuclear response and an overwhelming response on our part would be so high as to be almost laughable. And don't you think that that's really the primary motivation here, aside from everything else that's been discussed? And if that really is the primary motivation, then it seems that we ought to consider doing almost anything now to avoid being in that situation, which history suggests might be much, much worse than perhaps any consequence we could suffer at the moment.
Yeah, Mark, thank you for that. Let me go to the Admiral again.
Mark, well said. And I think Kim Jong-un's initial thought here is to preserve his regime. His secondary objective would be to use those weapons, as you say, to hold the region hostage, with the objective there, frankly, of dominating the Korean Peninsula. And so that's understandable within the construct of his mind. So your question is, should we solve the problem now on the Korean Peninsula or wait until it arrives on the, if you will, the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State? And it's tempting to say, yeah, let's just solve it now. Let's launch a massive military strike. The problem with that is it would lead to probably 2 million deaths minimum on the Korean Peninsula. And I would almost be willing to accept that if I didn't think we still had economic and diplomatic cards to play. We may hit that point, Mark, but I don't think we're quite there yet. So I'd rather see us play the other things we've talked about this morning, get to the table, have the talks. We still have time to do the massive military strike if we have to. Let's hope we don't get to that point.
And let me thank Mark for the call. You know, you've said on a couple of occasions, I believe, Admiral, that we have common cause with Russia and Afghanistan. Putin has been very critical of the United States vis-a-vis North Korea. And in fact, he talks about the people being willing to even eat grass if it came to that to protect the present regime. Can we make common cause with Putin here where North Korea is concerned?
I think we can, and that's why I indicated earlier the potential of six-party talks to include Russia as opposed to only four-party talks. And I think that although Russia has a tactical interest in kind of poking and provoking the United States, I think President Putin knows that in the end the global economy is at stake here if we had a nuclear exchange on the Korean Peninsula, and therefore he does have common cause with us. What he would like is to diminish our role in this crisis, and we need to make sure that we stand and are counted in leading the way through the diplomatic, the economic moves to play here. He knows he can't supplant us because of sheer throw weight of capability. But I think there's trade space in there to get Russia on board. As I have said in the past, we should be able to do as well in Afghanistan.
Well, you've written in your book about the Mediterranean is, where the war at sea began, and Russia still has a kind of war going on with respect to Syria in the Mediterranean, don't they? They want a base there.
They do indeed, and I think the strategic risk-reward calculus is different for Russia in the eastern Mediterranean. They do want a base in Syria. They want a voice in the Middle East. They want to create an anti-American axis working with the Iranians. They want to demonstrate to the world that they're a reliable partner, even to someone like Assad. And above all, Putin wants to play in his own country. He wants to demonstrate to his people that he's a strong, important international leader. I don't think there's a lot of room for a constructive conversation, at least in the moment in Syria, but I think there is in the Pacific on North Korea.
Admiral, Commander, good to have you on. Appreciate very much your being with us.
Michael, thank you much, and I'll be in the Bay Area in a month or so.
Yeah, you're going to be at Marines Office Memorial in San Francisco on the 20th at 5:30 p.m. I hope people will come out and turn out to see you, and hope we can see you again. Thank you so much again for joining
us. You bet. Thank you, Michael. Bye-bye.
Admiral James Stravitis, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, former commander of NATO. His new book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. When we return, we're going to talk with novelist Robin Sloan. He's got a new novel out called Sourdough. He'll join us in the hour ahead. Stay tuned for that. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.